what is the foundation of happiness or a happier life in a human being existence?
I think there's more to it than something simple, but I think certainly using your time wisely and caring about others, I think is really having that compassion and helping other people, I think is a foundational piece of a happy life. I think the more we think about ourselves and we're self-absorbed, I think that leads to unhappiness. So I think it's almost like Martin Luther King Jr. who said, like, what are you doing for others? I think he said one of the most important questions you can ask is, how are you helping others? And I think that when you can really answer that, that leads you in a good direction, a happier direction.
Hello, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, this is Nishant and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. My mission is to help people get in touch with their emotions and feelings, connect to themselves and being a source of healing. My job on this show is to sit with the world-class experts to deconstruct the practices, routines and habits to help you live a fulfilled and abundant life. I have a request for you this time. If you have been listening to this podcast for some time, and if you find it useful, please, please help me in spreading the word about this little show by telling one person in your friends, family, or even in your professional circle. That would mean the world to me, and thank you so much for that in advance. And today's guest is Maureen Healy. Maureen is an award-winning author, sought-after speaker, and expert in children's emotional health. She writes a popular blog for Psychology Today, which has reached millions worldwide. Maureen's most recent book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, Paraphrased from Dalai Lama, won the Nautilus Book Award, Book Excellence, and Forward Indie in 2019. With more than 15 years of experience, Maureen has guided thousands of parents and their children, worked with educators globally, taught in the classroom, and given keynote talks throughout North America, Europe, and Asia. In 2007, she lived at the base of the Himalayas, teaching kindergarten to Tibetan refugee children and studying with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in his temple with many others. And without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Maureen. Maureen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. And I am actually thinking, where should we start from? So the point that comes to my mind is, I'm going back to 2007. You traveled to Tibet and Dharamshala in India. So could you tell us a story about a monk and monkeys that you encountered with?
Oh, you're good, by the way. That's a great story. Yeah, in 2007, I was actually in New York City working at a clinic, and I really wanted to see how people help children from a different cultural standpoint. And I'd been studying Buddhism, and I had gone to Dharamsala. And there was an afternoon I had free from working at the kindergarten, and I decided to go for a hike. So I was on the way up a mountain, saw a beautiful view, and the sun started to set. So I was like, oh, I better get down. And then as I was coming down, I came across a bunch of monkeys in front of me that were showing their to me, that were really like, you know, in a scary way. Obviously, they were protecting their younger babies. And they started to almost surround the area. They blockaded it so I couldn't go down the mountain. And I was really I was frozen in fear. I was like, oh my goodness. And in my mind, I was like, I could go up the mountain. I could sleep up here. It's not the worst thing in the world. Like I was going through, but I was definitely stuck. And a monk came by and he's like, do you want to go through? And I said, absolutely. And he just had this air of confidence and clarity and ease. And he's like, follow me. And then he walked with ease and walked straight. And the monkeys parted as if it was the Red Sea. And I just followed him. And it was one of those moments in life where, well, not only did you feel divinely protected, but you recognize, oh, I want what this person has, that inner confidence, that you know, faith in oneself, that foundation of a happier life, what many people call, you know, some level of resilience and clarity.
Did you get a chance to talk to that monk, how he developed that inner confidence, clarity, and calm peace?
Such a good question. I didn't necessarily follow up with that monk in particular because I was so stunned in the moment. I was like, there was that part of your brain that's like, how did that just happen? Because I was frozen in fear. And he came and he had all the faith in the world. If I followed him, they would just part, and they did. So I had spoken to other people afterwards, but he just did me a wonderful service in that moment, because from a standpoint of worry or anxiety or like getting out of the present moment, I was in that moment, I was already ready to pack up my bags and sleep at the top of the mountain. So it's amazing after training and practice how you can get better at things that, you know, were scary beforehand.
I can understand the fear of monkeys because I grew up in India and I have seen so many monkeys growing up.
Yeah.
So Maureen, why did you go to Tibet and Dharamshala? What was your motivation to go there?
Well, I was invited to go there I was studying at a Buddhist center on the East Coast, and I was invited through sort of friends. And I really just wanted to see, you know, because ultimately parents, teachers, adults, we all want our children to become happier, but it was the how that, you know, people get, I don't want to say stuck in, but the how is where it's really the rubber meets the road. And I wasn't seeing at that time, you know, a great answer to the question of how do you help children become happier? And having studied Buddhism and really delving deeper into that, I wanted to go see firsthand, you know, these Tibetan refugees who, you know, didn't necessarily have 2 rupees to rub together, but they were happier. You know, what was it that they had? What could I learn from that experience? So that was my motivation.
What did you find? Or what was the reason of their happiness in Tibet?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, in the United States, we're a culture of many cultures, right? We're a melting pot. But there is the Tibetan refugees, the one culture, and it's really, you know, such a spiritual basis for their culture of awareness of that resiliency. And that, you know, they have, you, as you, I'm sure, are aware, and many people who are listening, they have a belief system that supports this idea that there's something within them that's greater than the outside world. And it's sort of a foundation of what I would say inner confidence, which I talked about in my first book, Growing Happy Kids. But you know, these people really focused on, you know, compassion, and they wanted to have fun too. And listen, everyone isn't happy-go-lucky all the time. That's not the point. But there is an awareness of wisdom, and there's an awareness of, or a focus on, how do you make this life meaningful? Let's put it that way. Like, there's a recognition that our life, we're here for such a short time. How do we use this precious time we're given?
What differences did you find between how Tibetan kids were raised and the kids raised in Western world?
Well, I was, at the time that I went over there, I was working in a clinic, and there was a lot of kids that I was working with that were medicated. And I am not for or against medication. I think that, you know, every situation is different, and there are times where it's completely appropriate and necessary for some children. But what I was seeing was an over-medication of children, and I wanted to see more natural methods. So that is probably a big difference. You know, the standpoint of, you know, when you have a Tibetan baby and you're bringing it home from the hospital, per se, you know, the first place you bring it is the altar in the house, and you say, hey, you know, in their language, in their manner, you know, this is going to, they've said, you know, this is the most important place for you. This is, you'll need this more than you need anything. So there is the concept of spirituality and wisdom and skill that is your first piece of the puzzle. Where here, I think in the United States, at least in the past, adults have often said, like, I have all the answers, you know, you're a blank slate. And that's just not what I believe. I believe that, you know, kids come preloaded with all these gifts and talents, and each child is amazing, and that each child is a spiritual being, you know, coming here for a certain reason, alive and well, oftentimes on planet Earth. So, and our goal is really, how do we not mess that up? And how do we help them gain the courage and the confidence and be able to be different and share their unique gifts with the world, because we need them. So that was a little, you know, that's just a different mindset from the get-go.
I want to touch upon the idea and the concept of Buddhism. Who introduced you to this Buddhism and the practice of Buddhism?
Who introduced me to this? That's a really good question. I had a friend when I lived in New York City who said, oh, you need to meet so-and-so friend. And then I met so-and-so friend and they said, hey, you should go to so-and-so meditation. And before I knew it, I went to so-and-so meditation and it was a Buddhist temple. And then I just, it's one of those things where it was like a duck to water. It was just like instantly I knew all these people and it was just, it resonated with something really deep in me where it was like the way that I saw the world, it made sense in that moment. Like the what, the, my perception, it had a place. It was, I've always looked at things more from that perception. And then when we put language to it, I was like, I get it now.
What kind of language?
Well, the idea of impermanence, the idea of like, there was just ideas that I had in my mind that I just wasn't introduced before that time in a formal way. So just concepts that I kind of intuitively or instinctually knew, but understanding them from a deeper level was really fascinating to me. Does that make sense? Am I being specific enough?
It is. Did your parents talk about spirituality, resilience, happiness, and all these practices when you were growing up?
Yeah. I mean, when I look back at my parents and growing up, I mean, I was raised Catholic. I went to Catholic schools I had a uniform until I was 18. I went to Jesuit high schools. So the idea of education was important and the idea of having a spiritual life and making like value-driven choices was important. But they were really strict with their practice. So they were, you know, they certainly believed they had a spiritual life. And let me think about this. Like we didn't talk about it a lot, I guess I would say. I always suggest for parents or adults to share sort of stories and myths and make it really come alive for children. But we didn't really talk about it, but they would have, you know, the Bible. And then on the table, there was even like the Course in Miracles, the book. And we had never talked about it, but that book was on the table. So obviously they were looking at that book, but we didn't have a dialogue about it. So they were a little bit private about those things, but they also were busy. My mom was an RN nurse and my dad was an electrical engineer. So, you know, they were busy with creating, you know, prosperous family life.
You seem to me someone having the understanding of both the worlds of Bible and Buddhism. Could you tell us the differences or anything that comes to your mind between Buddhism and Christianity, Catholic, Bible, so to speak?
Well, I think, you know, the elements are the same in so many great religions, right? The idea of forgiveness, love, compassion, tolerance, you know, the concepts are similar. And the way that my perception is, you know, Jesus was a great teacher, right? He was an amazing teacher. And Buddha was a phenomenal teacher, right? Talk about a wisdom teacher. So from my standpoint, it's always like you need to get the right teacher for you. And for some people, it's one teacher. Some people, it's another teacher. But the elements are all the same. You know, we're all brothers and sisters. And it just is a matter of, you know, the stories that were told and how we connect to different things. But I think that they both have what I would call higher octaves and perhaps lower ones. I mean, certainly the qualities of love and compassion and forgiveness and tolerance in this world, right? Equanimity in this world and being able to make choices that are good for you and good for others that are based on, you know, integrity and values and character, you know, go across any of the great religions. So That's where I see them all syncing up.
Do you have any concrete Buddhism practice in your everyday life?
Yeah, I do particular meditations every day and sort of chants and prayers. So that's helpful to me. I really love chanting. I think that as an author or someone who likes to do some speaking work, that's particularly meaningful.
How does it help you?
Well, I can get really, I want to say in my mind, I can intellectualize something, but I think when I do the chanting, it really centers me and clears me and helps me get to a place of calm and peace and connection, really. I think it's the word connection.
Are you allowed to speak about the mantras in that chanting?
I'm probably allowed to speak about it, but it's stuff I don't typically talk about, only just because it's sort of private. But I do love the chants. I do feel like chanting is just a particular way. I mean, even if you think, we were talking about Buddhism and Christianity, even if you think about energy medicine, right? The idea of clearing your chakras so that you can be a clear channel and that you can really be able to really be a better host for source is really what I would say. I think that that's helpful. That's where I see mantras really helping.
You mentioned about chakras. Could you describe in brief what chakras are to our listeners if anybody is not aware of that?
My second book. No, we moved on from my first book to my second book now. My second book is The Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids. And that's about energy and how these children have like a strong and fierce energy. But the chakras are age-old system for, and you know, there's lots of chakras, but we typically talk about the seven main chakras and their energy center on our body from our feet to above our crown. Those are the seven main ones, and they're front and back, front of our body and back of our body. And keeping them clear is helpful because it supports your overall health and well-being.
Got it. And you have a doctorate degree in child clinical psychology. So Maureen, I'm going to ask you, why did you study this? Was there anything connected to your childhood that you wanted to uncover? Why? Why did you do that?
Yeah, knowing your why is a good one. Why did I go? I mean, I knew I was working with adults before I went back to school to work with children. And I found that adults often, I was working with CEOs even more specifically. And I thought, oh, some of these CEOs act like children. So I should go study children. Because if I could help kids when they're younger, then I wouldn't have to be working with people, you know, 40 years into their career who still were acting like children. So that was my experience. But I went back because I felt called to work with children. And I felt like I needed a degree. I mean, you don't necessarily, depending upon what you're doing, but you certainly need a foundation of knowledge and experience. And I really wanted to know on a deeper level more about children. So although I went to school for child clinical psychology, I don't work in that field of clinical psychology because when I went to school, it wasn't really positive psychology. It was more like, what's wrong with you? And my mindset is like, what's right with you and how can we make things better? You know what I mean? And happiness to me, or becoming happier, isn't about all rainbows and unicorns. It's about how do we use the dirt of our life and plant more positive seeds and be able to use the challenges as stepping stones. So I didn't get a lot of that information from traditional school, but I really feel like that background, that foundation of traditional school will always help me because I know cognitive development. Like I have some deep areas of expertise with child development. And to me, that's helpful because when I see a child, I know I get where they're supposed to be. It's almost like when I work with a child and I work with their mind, it's like I'm opening up like the hood of a car. I know where the engine should be. I know where the oil is. I know where the windshield wiper is. Like I get where the pieces are and I can see when there's a problem.
You mentioned about child development and I am a huge fan of Dr. Gabor Mate. He talks about child development and how the parents' stress comes onto children and how children how the children have stress, ADHD, and it all comes down to parenting. So what do you think about that? What are your thoughts on parenting to develop a resilient and emotionally healthy child?
Well, I don't give parents all the credit or all the fault. I think every child has their own path, but certainly it's kind of like, you know, is it nature or nurture, right? But certainly parents and teachers and caring professionals working with children all have a huge influence on a child, especially if you work with them and do what I would consider daily habits. I really think we are a result of our habits. So if you can create a habit with your child, say they were struggling to be optimistic. I mean, in our pandemic and the time right now, I mean, there are a lot of kids right now who just are, the glass is either half full or it's empty, you know? So helping them, even if it's, you know, three good things, every day do three good things. What were three good things from the day? You know, the science shows after 21/28 days, depending on the child, their mind starts to look for the good things in the day. And that's really helpful. So using some, you know, evidence-based tools and ideas to help children bounce back and fill their reserves so their bucket isn't empty is really important because it helps you as a parent too. Oftentimes I'll teach a child like a breathing technique or something like that, and they bring it home to their family. And then before you know it, they're telling their mom or their dad, like, hey, I think you need that breathing exercise. Because you're right. It becomes a family practice. And I think that that's valuable.
So you mentioned about talking about or discussing about three good things. What other habits and practices we can have our children to look into?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many. But in my book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, I talk about like an exercise, hand on the heart, right? So at night, you know, as a child's really beginning to relax, not when they're stressed out, but when they're starting to relax, you have them put one hand on their heart and maybe one on their tummy, but one hand on their heart, and they feel what relaxation feels like. They feel their bodies relaxing. They feel their breath calming down. They start to feel like, oh, I'm relaxed. All is well. So that they do that every night for a few weeks, you know, then they have a tool that they can use if they're at school or they're not close by, where they put their hand on their heart and they can, their body automatically remembers, oh, when I do this, I can relax. You know what I'm saying? So it's like a visceral memory in their body that says, oh, when I put my hand on my heart, I can relax. So they're learning how to self-soothe and self-regulate. So that's helpful. And I also like mottos or mantras, meaning like, you know, kids come up with silly ones, right? So if there's a big emotion, they might say like, hey, I'm the boss, applesauce, and get rid of you. Like if it's anger or, you know, something, you know, all is well, or, you know, they come up with sayings that help them talk through a moment that maybe previously would have emotionally hijacked them. So they're learning how to put tools in their emotional toolbox, right? So that's what we do over the course of a lifetime. I always ask kids, I say, you know, this, like becoming healthy and happier, it's not like a course you pass in school and a box you check. It's something throughout life. You know, one week we may be learning tolerance, another week is forgiveness, another week is gratitude. So those are all helpful. I do like the gratitude practices with kids too. I think the actual act of helping them learn how to not only appreciate things, which is feeling like really grateful, but actually demonstrating the gratitude. So like sending someone a letter or calling someone and saying, thank you so much for that, or telling their teacher that really was helpful to me. You know, like being able to demonstrate gratitude, even if it's, you know, once a week, you know, gratitude Thursday or who knows what, but you know, you doing it so that they get into that habit, and maybe that if they see you do it, would be good. But if they learn how to do it, they'll feel in their bodies like, oh, this feels good for me. And look, that person got so happy. So they'll start to, you know, begin to recognize what moves them toward their emotional health and what maybe takes them away from it.
I am not a parent yet, so I am going to be asking you some of the imaginary questions based on my research and study. So Maureen, if as a listener to this podcast, if my child is struggling with emotions, any unhealthy emotions or stress, so how should we start the conversation about emotions, gratitude, what would be the first few healthy steps and ways to have this conversation?
It's different for every child, right? Like, so there's not a cookie cutter answer, but the things that I'd be looking at would be like, how old is the child, right? And depending upon how old they are, would depend on how I went at it. I typically, unless it's a big situation, I don't tend to go at things directly, because kids, like if you ask a kid when they come home from school, how was your day? They're like, fine. Anything new? Nope. You know, like, they don't want to talk about it. They don't need another homework assignment to talk to you about what happened all day. So, but I would make time to like enter their world, whether that was playing Minecraft with them, the video game, or being outside and jumping on the trampoline together. I would give an opportunity so that you would have a little bit of time together. So if something came up, they could share it with you. And I would try and continue to, you know, to the best of your ability, be a non-judgmental person where they felt like they were a safe space to land. Because when kids are really young, they're inquisitive, they're asking you questions, they want to learn about the world, and you just want to keep that line of communication open. So when they're in middle school and they have questions about other things, they'll ask you. Or high school, you want them to feel comfortable enough that, like, if there was a whole group of kids and they were all getting into a car, but someone was drinking, they would feel comfortable and courageous enough to call you and say, "Mom, can you pick me up?" And do you know what I mean? So you want that line of communication open, and you want that relationship strong. And oftentimes those relationships are stronger and open when you have fun together. You know what I mean? When you do things that are just for the sake of enjoyment. And then you can work on the other things, which are, hey, let's do yoga together, or let's do more practices that maybe are more directly related to feeling good, or take a mindfulness walk, or do something else that feels like it's maybe something that has a lot of different goals. But I like the idea of just, you know, we all get caught up in our work and in our lives. And of course, there's a bunch of different stressors today. But if we can just have fun with each other, we can help each other out through the not so fun moments.
What if a child is intense and rebellious and not listening to their parents?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my standpoint, you know, I've always liked defiant children, because there is an element where, even though it looks quote unquote like bad behavior on the outside, they're not listening to me. There's an element of that, which is the subtext is really like, hey, I'm listening to myself and I'm not listening to you, and myself doesn't want to do X, Y, Z. So they could be like, I'm not putting my socks on. I'm not going to school. I refuse to go to grandma's house on Sunday, whatever it is. So the whole point is, like, you know, in the quote unquote olden days, you would just punish them, right? You would say, that's it. But today we don't do as much punishment as we partner with them, and we try to incentivize them. We try to say, hey, and there are times as a parent or teacher, you say, like, this is it. It's this way, or that's it. There's no negotiation. But oftentimes in life, we can work with someone who is being a little more defiant and say, all right, well, this is, give them more information. This is why we need to do X, Y, Z, or give them, even the perception of choices often helps. Like, you can do your homework now, you can do it in an hour, or you can do wake up really early before your school and do it. You know what I mean? Like, the idea that, because one of children's biggest complaints is that they're always having to do things they don't want to do and they don't have any choices. So that's where a lot of the defiance comes from. They're like, no, I refuse. I'm done. You know, we all have our breaking points, right? So that's when a kid is like, I am done. And quote unquote bad behavior, from my perspective, is it's like a child's having an emotion and they don't yet have the skills to handle it. So they're basically saying, hey, I don't have the skills to deal with this. I don't know what to do right now. And that's why I'm behaving badly. So we just have to work with them and focus on skill development. And, you know, listen, I think parenting is probably the hardest job on the planet. So I think that, you know, we have to give ourselves a break. We're not supposed to be perfect. But, you know, repairing relationships is part of it. You know, we're all growing and learning.
I'm not sure if you do have kids. Do you have kids?
I do not have children, no.
So I will not go to my follow-up questions in that case. So I will change the trajectory.
But I would say, you know, I'm working on developing a school to open in September 2023. And I do have a big practice of kids I work with on Zoom around the world. So it's like, I don't have biological kids, but I feel like I have a lot of kids that text me, like, can you pick me up from so-and-so and do this? So it's an interesting relationship, because I'm always encouraging parents to, like, help form a happiness team around their kids. And that may be the parents, and there may be other people from society that can help their children. So that's, I'm a big believer in that.
So what was your relationship with your parents?
I had a good relationship with my parents. I mean, they both passed relatively young. One was sick and one was an accident. So I've done way too many eulogies way too early in life, but I really love and treasure them. I mean, they gave me such an important value on education and a value on being a good person. You know what I mean? And the appreciation for love, you know, really doing my best to lead with love. And, you know, that's not always easy, right? It's some moments in life are challenging.
Yes. And I want to ask you more on the emotionally healthy child. Is there a basic difference between emotional child and emotionally healthy child? And the reason I'm asking you, because while growing up, I was an emotional child, but I wasn't emotionally healthy child. I didn't know how to process my emotions because nobody was talking about it around me. So what is the difference between emotional child and an emotionally healthy child?
Yeah. So an emotional child is someone who's, you know, really sensitive and has big feelings. And that's a lot of children. The concept of the emotionally healthy child is, you know, it's really how to help a child go from struggling to flourishing, right? So it's a continuum. So it's how do you help, you know, think of it like a balance beam. If you have ever gone on a balance beam and you fall off and you get back on, you know, emotional health is the skill of balance. So it's how do you, you know, when you deal with stress or you deal with anxiety or you deal with anger, or you deal with frustration, we often all begin with like a knee-jerk reaction. You know, you get really angry, a younger kid slams the door and screams or whatever. But with time, they can learn to slow down, catch themselves, calm, and then make a smarter choice that's good for them and good for others. So the emotionally healthy child is learning how to make those smarter choices. They're not perfect, but they're putting skills and ideas in their toolbox. An emotional child, if I'm understanding you correctly, it's the child that is emotionally, you know, sensitive and has big reactions. And we all go from being reactive to responsive. And responsive is more conscious, more deliberate. And, you know, that's the path. It doesn't mean everyone gets to go from, we all know adults that are reactive and they stay reactive. But if you want to move forward on the path of emotional health, you're going to go from, you know, less conscious or less deliberate choices to more conscious, to more deliberate. And the reason why I think it's so important is because it's the path to a happier life experience. You know, you don't want to be constantly feel like you're thrown around on the ocean of emotions. You want to feel like you're driving the bus, you know?
Yeah, I will assume that a lot of families will have parent-child relationship issues. So how should parent develop the awareness that they need help, they need external help to work with their children and kids?
I mean, I think that when I was growing up a few moons ago, parents just didn't ask for help. That was part of the culture. You just did what you did and you spanked your kids or you did the best you could and that was it. Nowadays, you know, it's really typical for parents to ask for help. You know what I mean? It would be like me trying to go outside and change my oil. I would really need a lot of help, and you know, with that. So, I mean, I could do it. I could do a YouTube and change the oil, but that's a lot of work. I'd rather bring it to a mechanic because it's not my specialty. So it's the same concept with parents. You can't be a specialist at everything. And if you feel like either your child is having a level of stress, you don't know if it's normal or typical, or they're worried, or they're having problems. I mean, I'm a big believer you should always consult an expert, you know what I mean? Or someone whose specialty that is. Even if it means you speak to them and you're like, oh, I'm doing everything right. That's great. Or maybe I can add a mindfulness practice, or maybe I can add something or delete something. You know, life isn't about addition. It can be about deletion as well. And this is kind of a side note, but I often find with parents that, like, when they change, when children's diet gets better, it's easier for them to control their emotions. So in my book, Growing Happy Kids, we talk about the 5 building blocks of confidence, but physical is the first one, making sure they physically feel their best. And we all know that intuitive and instinctually, but you know, it's really dialing into different pieces that we may not be experts at. And just because, you know, every child is different. So I think each child demands something a little bit different of us. And when you have multiple children and you're just one person, it requires time and patience. And we just have to do our best. It's, no one has to be perfect.
And what does mindfulness for children look like? Do we have different sort of practices for children, or this mindfulness is just same for adults and children?
I mean, I think that mindfulness is mindfulness, but the how it lands in a child's mind is different. So the idea of children are, you know, they're so fun and amazing beings, but they tend to move quickly. That's just what they do most often. Not all kids, but a lot of kids. And part of mindfulness is like slowing down a little bit, right? So with kids, often it has to do with slowing down. So it could be going for a walk, and on the walk, let's talk about everything we see that's purple. You just having them slow down and learn how to pay attention and develop the attentional skills is really valuable. In my book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, I give some mindfulness exercises so that they can begin to spot emotions in their body. For example, the emotion of anger, before it gets to anger, it's like annoyance, frustration, irritation. So I explain to kids, it's like a volcano, right? Before a volcano erupts, a volcanologist, a scientist, you know, is tracking that volcano, right? They're measuring the temperature. They're seeing if the plates underneath the volcano shift. They're looking for the signs. And it's the same thing we have to do with our bodies. What are your personal physical signs when you're starting to get frustrated or annoyed? So it's helping kids start to get that self-awareness and that mindfulness so that they can begin to make better choices. So mindfulness or self-awareness is so important, because you really can't be emotionally healthier and happier until you start to really see your role in it and pick up your own signs to make those better choices.
What are your personal mindfulness practices?
I do my best to be mindful as much as possible. I mean, I guess from my standpoint, I'm in nature a lot. So I live on a mountain. And so I really feel very connected to hawks and the deer and even the bobcat that lives by me. So I'm very in tune with them. So that feels a little bit like a mindfulness practice, to just slow down, to calm, to center myself, to become really aware of everyone around me. And I do my best to do that as much as possible. I mean, it's easier for me to answer when I slip up on mindfulness. I think when I slip up is sometimes my tricky spot is driving. I get frustrated when I drive sometimes. So that's the place where I have to do my best to be as mindful as possible. Not that, I mean, I'm a great driver, but I grew up on a different coast. So people drive differently here. So being really calm is a good thing in the car, of course, but also allowing people, like I grew up where it was more aggressive driving in a city. So I have to just sort of recalibrate myself, if that makes sense.
It does. And every frustration, every unpleasant emotion has a trigger. So Maureen, what is your trigger behind your frustration when you drive, if anything comes to your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just being, I think our bodies get calibrated to where we live and grow up. And I grew up and learning how to drive in a city, like certain ways of driving to me seem normal, but they're not normal where I live now. So I have just had to create a real mindfulness practice about going slow. If someone jumps out in front of my car and is walking on a crosswalk, I start imagining them as a baby elephant because I love baby elephants. So if I see them as a baby elephant, I'm like, oh, no problem. It's a beautiful baby elephant. If I see them as an annoying person who just jumped in front of my car, that's a different emotion. Do you know what I'm saying? So I have tricks that help put me back into a calm and peaceful place. Let's put it that way.
What are those tricks?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like imagining that person as a baby elephant. Like when they...
That's it?
That's helpful to me because people where I live, they don't necessarily look both ways before they go into the crosswalk. So it's not a city per se. So I think, oh, okay, let's just slow down, calm, you know, their baby elephant, and then I'm fine.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York.
New York City.
Mm-hmm. I grew up on Long Island, but I learned how to drive in New York.
And in the preparation of this conversation, I read that you were a wild child. Could you share one of your memorable childhood challenges if anything comes to your mind?
Well, I think I was always, I had a lot of energy. I still do have a lot of energy. So I think that's one of the big things with children is like, how do you help them learn how to channel that energy? Because, you know, not everyone can easily deal with a child with lots of energy. So when I was younger, you know, if I got frustrated or I needed some time alone or I needed some peace and quiet, we had trees in our backyard. So I would literally go climb a tree and go to the top of the tree. And that was always fun for me. So I think we all sort of intuitively do our best to learn how to self-regulate. And I think, like in my book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, the whole idea is to give ideas and tools to make people's lives easier, you know, and that's good.
Yes. You have touched upon happiness many a times in our conversation. You also studied with the Dalai Lama. Could you share with us what is the foundation of happiness or a happier life in a human being existence?
I think there's more to it than something simple, but I think certainly using your time wisely and caring about others, I think is really having that compassion and helping other people, I think is a foundational piece of a happy life. I think the more we think about ourselves and we're self-absorbed, I think that leads to unhappiness. So I think it's almost like Martin Luther King Jr. who said, like, what are you doing for others? I think he said one of the most important questions you can ask is, how are you helping others? And I think that when you can really answer that, that leads you in a good direction, a happier direction.
And there are so many researches and case studies when you are feeling depressed and low, just go out, help somebody else.
100%.
Yes. So what was it like to study with Dalai Lama? Do you remember any conversation, any encounter, incidents with him?
Well, it was me and a group of people. But I mean, I think that when you're in someone's orbit like him, who's just an amazing, you know, being on this planet, I mean, you can't help but become happier. There's in Buddhism, they say there's two ways to learn things. It's caught and taught. So taught is your regular traditional way, you know, someone's, you know, explaining a concept. But caught is when you're in the presence of someone who is just extraordinary and a little bit of their magic rubs off on you. So I think that's why you want to go connect with people, because that's how people can shift their consciousness, is by both of those pieces. And that's what when you get in, you know, someone's purview who's really done the work, so to speak, and who is, you know, he is, you know, obviously a unique being on the planet. But, you know, I mean, when you get around someone who really is an expert in their field, you can feel something. There's something that person sparks in you. And I think that's really extraordinary.
You also have studied with many other happiness teachers globally, such as Tal Ben-Shahar and many others. So what common denominator do you see among those happiness teachers who are spreading happiness and love throughout the world?
Yeah, I would say there's two things come to mind. It's the first one is they have a very good balance between their intellect and their intuition. So they're both right and left brain. There's a balance. They're not all one or all the other. There's a real rigor that they put to both. And I would say the other piece is that they're fully, completely, unbelievably committed to helping others. And I think that those two pieces to me have been a theme. You know, there are people who want to live a life that's, you know, unicorns and rainbows and butterflies, which is beautiful and amazing. But we have days that feel like lemons and some days are just a lemon. So we have to be able to deal with all of life and provide wisdom and skill and helpful practices so that people can move in a healthy, happier direction. And life is so fast. I mean, I really feel like all the time we have is so precious. So using it wisely, I think, is really important.
Do you rely on your intuition more or intellect? Or how do you find the balance?
I do write about it in The Emotionally Healthy Child a little bit. But I think that everyone has different proclivities and capacities. And I think that one of the things that I'm personally good at is I have a balanced right brain and left brain, but not everyone has that. But I think that, you know, that's why I liked going to school, right? Because you can use your left brain and you really, but that's also, I mean, I think that also, you know, meditation, different things, some of that stuff is right brain stuff. So, and analytical meditation obviously is left brain. So I think doing different things that help each side of the brain so you have a balanced brain is very good. Because if we think about our children, we want them to be able to having a big feeling is no problem, but you want them to be able to catch themselves, take a pause, apply a strategy. That's more left brain, right? So there's a lot of practices you can do with kids that help develop that whole brain thinking. So, you know, learning a language is both right and left brain, right? So doing a puzzle, that's both right and left brain, right? So there's different things you can do that are both right and left brain. So when you do that and you do the running and returning between both sides of the brain, you're developing that ability to be intuitive and also to be intellectual about something.
And trusting yourself.
Well, trusting yourself is the foundation for good instincts or intuition. I mean, you have to learn how to trust yourself.
And Maureen, you have suggested so many practices such as breathing for children, taking a pause. I think we can apply all these skills as an adult. It doesn't have to be tied to a kid, right?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest feedback I get from my book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, they said, forget the kid. This is what I need. And that's the truth, because if we're going to teach someone, we have to be able to embody it. And again, emotional health is a lifelong endeavor, right? So what works for us as adults will work for kids or vice versa. So I think it's really the basics, whether it's the breathing or the meditation or learning how to slow down. I even help parents, like, I'm like, you can, you know, praise a child when they can, who can like set the table the slowest? Because the whole point is you want to slow down and make smart choices and make choices guided by wisdom. So absolutely, everything is for adults as well.
And I would love to ask you about some of the books that you might have gifted the most. Besides your own books?
That's a really good question. And I know I should have a really good answer, but I don't necessarily. No, because I always try. I mean, I love to read. I can't even tell you how many times I've sat down with a book and I haven't gotten up till the book has been completed. So not everyone has that luxury of time, but I do my best to buy a gift for someone that they would want. So I can't say that there's one book I feel like everybody should read. I really do my best to tailor gifts.
Anything comes to mind that you would have gifted based on their preference?
You know, it depends on the person. I mean, I've given some of Thich Nhat Hanh's books out. I've given some of Mark Nepo's books out. I've given some of Dalai Lama's books out. I mean, it's more of like the person and what I feel like they might love. I'm a big fan of John O'Donohue, the poet. I think his work is fabulous. I think poetry is a beautiful thing to have in your life. So it really depends on the person and, you know, what I think might resonate with them.
What advice would you give to your 15-year-old self? Just giving a number, random number.
if I think 15, that's probably like a sophomore in high school. Well, first of all, I'd tell you, you are going to pass the driver's education test. The driver's ed, you will get your license. And I would say that you can do it. Really, the world is your oyster. I mean, that there is the real, it's on your side. I mean, I feel like it's that question that Einstein says, one of the important questions is this a friendly universe or not? And I guess I would want to tell her, hey, it's a friendly universe. You got this.
I heard that you love children jokes. Do you have any joke to share with us?
Oh, you're very funny. Let's see. What was the joke that I told my niece today? I'm not sure if she thought it was terribly funny, but I had the joke. What did the elephant say when they were caught skinny dipping? And keep in mind, she's 8 years old. The answer is we were told we just needed our trunks. So I try to get the joke for her age group because she's very literal. So the idea of trunks and trunks, it meaning two different things, that was very funny for her.
Yes, and it seems that we have gotten good data points to wrap up this conversation. So Maureen, is there anything you want to share or explore in this conversation more?
I would just say that, you know, if people want to reach out to me, my website is growinghappykids.com and my last book, The Emotionally Healthy Child, might be helpful. It comes in audio too. I know people, I read the audio, which was really fun, by the way. If anyone's an author, that's a wonderful experience. So I know that people are busy now, but sometimes, you know, when you're doing the dishes or something, a little audio is helpful.
Great. And I would like to conclude our conversation by one of the quotes from Khalil Gibran that I copied from your website. Our parents bring us into the world, but in the end, we are responsible for what we become. So Maureen, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight.
This episode is brought to you by my own Friday newsletter. Every Friday, I share a newsletter which describes my new learnings. And these learnings can be in the form of new books I'm reading, different podcasts, and blogs I'm exploring to learn new topics such as trauma healing, relationships, mindfulness, psychology, and much, much more. You can find the newsletter link at my website, https://nishantgarg.me. nishantgarg.me. Once again, nishantgarg.me. And thank you so much for listening to this show. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.